On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning and trumpet blasts. There was fire and smoke. The earth shook beneath the Israelites' feet. They staggered back in fear and awe as they watched the God of the universe descend upon Mount Sinai. And God spoke these words, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." The Ten Commandments given by God to Israel and thus to the world out of the storm on Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments are the foundation. The Old Testament law, or Torah, encompasses all of God's decrees that he gave to the Israelites in this time after the Exodus. But clearly, these Ten Commandments are the core, the foundation upon which it rests. These were stipulations of the covenant, as I mentioned a moment ago, the covenant God was making with the Israelites. The NIV study note on this section explains that in that day and time, when a king was making a covenant with another king who was coming subject underneath him, or a people group who was coming subject underneath him, the people would use a certain form for writing out these covenants. And you see this here in Exodus chapter 20. They would always start with something called a preamble, where the superior king would identify himself. That would be followed by a historical prologue where that king would recount the acts of all the good things he had done for these people. And then that would be followed by the stipulations of the covenant. Take a look at Exodus 20, verse 2. Here's where the king identifies himself. "I am the Lord your God." Verse 2 also serves as the brief historical prologue. "I am the one who brought you out of your slavery in Egypt." I think we saw some of that historical prologue last week too when we were looking at Exodus 19. And if you glance at verse 4 of Exodus 19, you'll see God saying, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." I think that's part of the recounting of the Acts, the historical prologue. So back to chapter 20. After verse 2, which included the preamble and the historical prologue, you start to get the stipulations of the covenant. This is a covenant agreement. God is becoming the king of the Israelites. They are becoming subject to him. Undoubtedly, this is one of the most important chapters in the Bible. And it's worth going through these commandments one by one. So let's do that together today. The first commandment, verse 3. "You shall have no other gods before me." Every nation back then had gods, or a god, that they worshipped. Remember the battle we just looked at a few weeks back when we were studying the 10 plagues that came upon Egypt. God turned the Nile River to blood, thus conquering the Egyptian god Hapi, who was considered to be the god of the Nile. The plague of darkness asserted his authority over the Egyptian sun god Ra. The frog god Heket was conquered in the plague of frogs. Hathor, the cow god, was defeated in the plague against the livestock, etc. So God starts his covenant stipulations with something that he has already made abundantly clear to the Israelites in recent days. This God with whom they were now interacting is the one true God, the real God, superior over all other gods. No other gods are to come before him. The Hebrew word translated there, before me, that word could also be translated in hostility toward. So this verse could be read, you shall have no other gods in hostility toward me. Are there things in your life that you worship besides the one true God? Is there anything in your life that you spend time on that could be interpreted as something in your life that stands in hostility towards this God? The proclamation here is that you are to rid yourself of that thing. Have no other gods before me. Have no other gods in hostility toward me. Second commandment, verse 4 to 6. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Notice that it says here that God is a jealous God. What image do you get in your mind if I ask you to think of a jealous person? I don't know about you, but my mind kind of wanders back to high school days, or I suppose after high school too, dating relationships. Let's imagine a hypothetical couple here. We'll call them Mike and Karen. Let's say they're dating, and then they break apart. And shortly after that, Karen starts dating another guy. Mike is filled with jealousy. What are the thoughts and feelings that Mike would be having at that time? He would be thinking, Karen should be with me and not that other bozo. Right? His feelings would be hurt because he wanted Karen to like him the best and give him all the attention. And it hurt to see her give attention to someone else. So let's think about the parallel here. We were created to be in a loving, not romantic now, but a loving relationship with our Creator God, says Scripture. In fact, we were created to look to God first before all others. What's the greatest commandment according to Jesus? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. You're to put God first. When God sees us moving away from him and not putting him first, this verse says he's jealous of that. Just as Karen moved away from Mike, God's thoughts are the same here. You should be with me and not that other bozo. Now, in the human situation, there's some weakness and some neediness and jealousy. Mike wanted Karen to fulfill his romantic need, so that's part of the reason for all the emotion here, that he has a need that is unmet. And he's also powerless to get Karen back. So this is kind of where the parallel breaks down. God does not have a romantic need for us. Theologians will tell you that God is fully sufficient within himself. He didn't create us out of a need. He created us because he wanted to share his love with us. He wanted to include us in his goodness. We also don't think of God as being powerless to do anything about the situation like Mike was. God can do whatever he wants. Instead, again, theologians talk about God limiting himself, deciding that he will not use his power to force us to love him. He gives us that choice. He limits himself there. If he forced us, we would be robots. He wants real love. So, This is not quite the same situation as what Mike is going through, but the basic thought is the same as Mike's. God looks at us and says, you should be with me and not that other bozo. The other bozo could be other gods. It could be anything that is in your life that you are giving higher attention to than the real God. Again, God's desire to have us love him is not out of a need. He desires this for us because it's the best thing for us. Because that's how he can shower his goodness upon us. He is the one who can meet the needs that he created us with. He's the provider of all good things. If we look for those things anywhere apart from him, in the end, we will find only emptiness. So, God is jealous for our attention. And he would say to us something like Mike was thinking, you should be most interested in me and not goofing around with that other person or that other thing, whatever that is. So he can be a jealous God. Remember in our study of the book of James, the apostle there exclaimed, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world means enmity against God? Therefore, anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Don't put the things of this world above God. That makes you an adulterer in your relationship with God, the one you were intended for. Don't cause him to be jealous. Put God first. All right, verses 5 and 6 contain a difficult passage. Let's consider it together. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So when I read this, I probably react like you do, and I think, oh man, if I mess up, my daughter Maya could get cursed by God, and maybe her children after that, and her children after that. And I say, how is that fair? I'm the one who messed up, not her. So this is one of those situations where it's helpful to go back to the time that this was written and the culture of that day. In ancient Near Eastern culture, which was the culture that the Israelites were a part of, people did not think about individual human beings in the same way that we think about them now. They thought much more collectively. A household back then would consist of many people. The man of the house, his wife or wives, his concubines, his many sons, and their children, and if the patriarch lived long enough, maybe even their children. It would all be one household. Commonly, there were 3 to 4 generations living within one household group. The man of the house, in some cases was the grandpa or the great-grandpa of the house, held all the power. He could do whatever he wanted with his children and wives. He was like a king who ruled over his realm. This is according to a journal called The Biblical Archaeologist. The man of the house was like a king who ruled over his realm. And just like the king of a nation, he could lead his people in good paths or in bad paths, and the people would suffer the consequences for good or for ill. They'd be affected by the choice of their leader. So a household was really looked at in that day as a group unit, not a collection of individuals like we look at it today. And the household often contained 3 to 4 generations. Sheds a little light on this passage when God says he will punish the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation. That might be one household group. Think about this also. I don't know if this is true, but let's think this. Think about this. Let's say God does think in more individualistic terms than what it looks like here. Let's say he does think more like we want him to, and he sees the value of the individual within the family group. I think there's a chance, as God brings this law into the consciousness of the Israelite people, I think that there's a chance that if he came out right away and said, I am only going to punish the individual who sins, I'm not going to punish the whole group. I think there's a chance that the Israelites might have looked at him and said, how is that fair? Of course you have to punish the whole group. They just thought differently than we do. So all kinds of things to think about and what God might have been doing here as he tried to bring a new level of morality to this ancient culture. Now, I want you to relax a little bit now because there are strong indications that God is very aware of the individual within the family group. Take a look at Deuteronomy 24. It says this, "Parents are not to be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their parents. Each will die for their own sin." Ezekiel 18, "The one who sins is the one who will die. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child." Jesus certainly teaches the importance of the individual. So there's a number of layers going on here in this teaching. And maybe we could just summarize it by just saying, beware sin. Sin has effects on the individual who sins. Sin has effects on your children, on your family, and on your friends. Beware sin. Don't miss that God finishes this segment by saying that he shows love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So verses 4-6, love God with your full heart. That's how it will go best with you. Don't make him jealous by turning your affection to something else other than him. Beware sin. Third commandment, verse 7. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. The commentators here think that this is really more about oath-taking, using God's name in an oath. Especially problematic if you use God's name in a false oath. Leviticus 19 says, "Do not swear falsely by my name and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." So this would be like the phrase that we hear from time to time these days, "I swear to God that's not true." Right? "I swear to God that's not true." Jesus gets into this in Matthew 5. And this is going to be my paraphrase of what he says. He says, "Why bring God's name into a statement like that? Who are you to put God's name into something that you're swearing? Can you even swear by your own head? Can you make one hair on your head black or one hair on your head white? No, you can't. So let's leave God's name out of this. Let your yes be yes and your no be no." In fact, he says, don't swear at all. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Now, typically when we look at this third commandment, I think what comes to our minds most frequently is this idea of using God's name in vain or using God's name as a curse word. I would say that if you are under the impression that using God's name as a swear word is forbidden by this commandment, I'd say just go on and keep believing that. Because I think that idea is well within the spirit of the third commandment. And in fact, it might be a worse thing than what's being forbidden here. To take God's name and use it as a curse word? Far be it from you, Christ followers, to do such a thing. Let's watch our language. Words matter. Don't say God like a curse word. Don't say Jesus Christ like a curse word. Don't break this command of the Lord's. The fourth commandment, verses 8 to 11. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one, the one to keep the Sabbath. And the reason is because I preached a whole sermon on it last August. And if you're interested in my thoughts on that, I'll direct you to the church website. It was last August, and the sermon was titled Sabbath Guilt. This is the commandment that kind of sticks out like a sore thumb sometimes. It's the one that maybe we aren't following regularly. It's the one that we wonder, should we be following it? I can tell you that the conclusion I reached in my sermon on this last summer was that New Covenant Christians are not bound to keep the Sabbath. However, they are invited to keep the Sabbath. Sabbath was created for man, not man for the Sabbath. This might very well be a wonderful practice to incorporate into your life out of love for God. Or perhaps at least incorporating some of the principles of Sabbath into your weekly schedule. But I don't believe we're bound to that. Again, more on that if you're curious on the church website. Fifth commandment. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. So this command does not say obey your parents. It says show honor to your parents. Obedience is a part of honor, to be sure. Respect, take care of, show love to. All of these ideas are wrapped up in this phrase, honor our parents. Our parents, on the flip side, are tasked elsewhere in Scripture with loving us, taking care of us, teaching us how to walk in good ways and godly ways. So if they're doing their part, then obeying them is going to be to our benefit. Unfortunately, many of us here today are very aware that sometimes parents don't do their part. Some parents don't lead in good ways. They don't show in love. Some parents are abusive. Our default setting should always be to try to obey this command and to try to show honor and respect to our parents. But clearly there are times when a child, and that this could be a young child, this could be an adult child, when for the sake of the health of the child, physically, emotionally, spiritually, that child needs to gain separation from the parent who is causing harm. But that should be a last resort. This is a good commandment. We should try to obey and show respect and love to our parents. And included in this concept, teenagers and kids, is the idea that sometimes your parents know best, even if you don't think they do. So, be obedient, children. Honor your father and your mother. We're on to the sixth commandment. Verse 13, you shall not murder. You would think that we shouldn't need this commandment, that humanity has grown past this. Seems like a no-brainer, but murder, as you know, still happens in our society on an awfully regular basis. And I would imagine many of you, like me, were reading about this young man who murdered someone in Wilmer not so long ago, who was on trial this week. You know, I cannot even fathom how a person could get to the point of actually plotting out and planning to kill someone. It boggles my mind, but it happens all the time. So you would think this commandment is one that we shouldn't need, that's an afterthought, but this is still a relevant command for people in our society today. Do not murder. This is a commandment straight from the lips of God. Jesus takes this commandment in Matthew chapter 5 and fleshes it into a whole different idea, a whole different level. He says we shouldn't just stop at not murdering somebody, but we're not even to let anger fester in our hearts towards a person. We're to drop everything that we're doing and pursue peace and reconciliation with that person with whom there is conflict. We're to strive to be at peace with everyone. So that's a whole different picture behind this. Don't murder, yeah, but also work to have peace with everyone, to resolve conflict, to achieve reconciliation. The words of Jesus. Seventh commandment, verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. Another no-brainer, correct? Of course we're not supposed to commit adultery. I found an article from the Washington Post dated 1998, and I'm quite sure this statistic is not any better between then and now, but that article said that 70% of marriages experience an adulterous affair on the part of one or the other spouse. That is a shocking number. That's a depressing number. People, guard your marriages against this. Adultery causes so much deep pain and suffering, so much damage. Don't let it happen. It's not going to stay secret. Don't fall for that lie. The truth comes out. So be on your guard. Guarding your marriage against adultery means making your marriages great. If your marriage is not great, this means getting into marriage counseling and staying committed, both of you, to working on your marriage until it is great. Most of the problems in marriage stem from poor communication, perhaps some unrealistic expectations or uncommunicated expectations, and these kinds of things can change through counseling. They can be molded and moved. So stay committed to doing whatever it takes to work on your marriage until it is great. A great marriage is the best antidote to an adulterous affair. Guarding your marriage against adultery also includes this concept. Do not allow yourself any special friendships with the opposite sex. You know, these things start innocently, I really believe that, but they can spin out of control in a hurry. No special friendships with the opposite sex when you are married. If there is one, say maybe a close friend from back in college days, then I think at the very least your spouse needs to be fully aware of your communication with that person. And if you're meeting with that person, I think your spouse should probably be there. No special friendships with the opposite sex. Guard your marriage. Stay far away from adulterous affair. This is terribly important, and in fact, it's one of the Ten Commandments. Jesus says again in Matthew 5 that you should not even fantasize about this situation. The thought itself is a sin. Run from adultery as Joseph ran from Potiphar's wife. You shall not commit adultery. The eighth commandment, verse 15, you shall not steal. God is your provider. If you need something, you turn to Him. You turn to your family. You turn to your friends. You turn to the church. You do not take something that doesn't belong to you. Ninth commandment, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Have you ever been tempted to say something about someone that is not true? Banish the thought. Christ followers are to be people of truth and love and light. You know who the great deceiver is. That's Satan. And when we lie, we're acting more like him than we're acting like Christ. Don't give false testimony. And the 10th commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. You know, most of the preceding commands all involved outward behavior, but now we transitioned into one that's internal. Similar to Jesus' command to not even think about committing adultery. Okay, this is one that goes on in our hearts and our minds. Coveting is something that plays out in our heads. To covet means yearning to possess something. Yearning to possess something. I think this is very similar to the idea of lust. It's the picture of someone taken with the thought of having something that is not theirs, whether that is money, a house, a car, a certain job, a person of the opposite sex, perhaps. And they play this thought over and over in their minds. They covet, they lust, they spend time thinking about how bad they want it, they set their heart upon it. God is our provider. He is the one who can give all things. He's supposed to be first in our heart, we've already said. He will bring good things to us. We're supposed to be content with what God brings to our lives. I know this is easier said than done, but why spend time thinking about things that are not ours? It's a waste of time, isn't it? Live life in the now. Pursue God and what He has for you now. Perhaps He'll answer a prayer of yours regarding something that you desire in the future. But in the meantime, don't give yourself needless frustration by playing these things over and over and over in your mind. Over not possessing that thing. You know, I've really been taken with this idea recently that Christ followers should be people who are living at peace. I just keep running into this theme again and again as I prepare sermons. We saw a moment ago that Jesus asked us to not only not murder people, but to run to situations to fix them if we have anger or something against a neighbor, to live at peace. I mean, that is a picture of a person at peace. And here we see it again. When we covet, when we lust, we're not at peace. We feel agitation and frustration because we don't possess the thing that we want to possess. But if we give these desires over to God, we ask Him to provide for us, and then we stop yearning for something that He has not given to us, or something that someone else has, then I think there's a measure of peace. I think we're called to live peaceful lives. Trust in God and His ability to meet your needs both here and in the promised land to come, and you will achieve peace. So don't covet. This commandment also indicates to us that the thoughts in our heads also are important and matter to God. Okay, let's finish up with the rest of this section in Exodus 20, starting in verse 18. When the people saw the thunder and the lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Don't be afraid. God has come to test you, so the fear of God will be with you and keep you from sinning." The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. You know, we could use a little thunder and lightning and fire every once in a while in our own lives, I think. Moses said that God was coming in this huge way, A, so that the Israelites would remember all of this, and B, so that when they were tempted to sin in the future, they'd remember some of this fear, and it would help them. I think we could use a little more fear now and then. It would help us stay on the straight and narrow. All right, two final thoughts before I move us to our conclusion this morning. The first involves something I keep bringing up, and it's just because it's so vital to our walk as Christ followers. I should ask the teenagers, who, I don't know, there's not very many of them back there, but we talked about this briefly on Wednesday night. What's the top two commandments in all of Scripture according to Jesus? I already mentioned the first one today, and I'm not really going to make you answer, Tom Witte. All right, first one, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And number two, love your neighbor as yourself. You know this. I agree with Paul's assertion in Romans 13. Take a look. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be, they're summed up in this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. So the last six of the Ten Commandments are going to be covered if you work hard at doing the second of the two greatest commandments that Jesus gives us. The last six of the Ten Commandments are all about showing love to people in the right way, even being consistent with your thoughts, loving people. If you're really good at obeying the second greatest commandment according to Jesus, then you would never think of stealing anything or committing adultery or coveting something that belongs to your neighbor. No, I don't want that for my neighbor. I love my neighbor. I'm glad my neighbor has that thing. Praise the Lord for that. So you'll be covered in the last six of the Ten Commandments if you are really good at loving your neighbor as yourself. You would never want to cause harm to anyone else. And then taking this idea from Paul and extrapolating it then, the first three of the Ten Commandments, and if you decide to keep the invitation of keeping the Sabbath, I think the fourth would be included here as well. These commandments are covered if you're doing a good job of following what Jesus says is the greatest of all commandments, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. If you are loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, then you're not going to put any other gods before Him, are you? You're not going to allow anything else in your life that is causing conflict in your relationship with God. You won't make an idol and bow down to it, of course. and you'll be sensitive about misusing the name of God in your speech. You'll put God first so he does not have to be jealous. And you do this because you know that he intends only good for you. We love him because he first loved us. So if the Ten Commandments are the foundation, the core of all Old Testament law, then Jesus' two greatest commandments are the summary of those ten. How important then, how vital are those two greatest commandments that Jesus gives us? Love God, give him first place in your life. Love your neighbor consistently in your thoughts and in your actions. These are things that we should always be thinking about as we go through our daily lives. My second thought before our conclusion is a brief one. I just want to remind you, there is grace. There is grace. We're talking a lot today about rules and rule breaking and rule following. The new covenant is one of grace. Because we're all rule breakers, and God knows this. He made a way for us anyway by paying the price that we deserved for breaking the rules. Freedom is not free. The rules are important. We need to follow them. But they are not what makes us clean and gets us to God. That's what Jesus did for us. So remember, there is grace. So these are the Ten Commandments. Scholars throughout the world, whether they believe in God or not, proclaim the Ten Commandments as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, statement of moral law ever written down in the history of humankind. We, of course, believe there is a reason that this is the greatest statement of moral law ever written down, and that is because we believe that it comes straight from God. God promised the Israelites that if they followed these commands, they would be blessed and they would have peace. And I believe we can say the same thing confidently here today to ourselves. If we follow his commands, we will be blessed, we will have peace in life, and really what more could we ask for than that? Follow the Lord your God. Obey his commands. Amen. May it be so.